Hello, and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Dan Bioki, Christopher Woodrow Butcher, Chip Zdarsky, and myself, David Brothers. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com. Beloved, we are gathered here today to discuss Heavenly Debut. Yeah, I said the intro right and then whiffed the intro, or whiffed segue.
Is that because we record on Sundays now?
Yeah, no.
Kind of a, yeah, now it's a all sermon dearly feel. Beloved. I love
it. Oh, man. We are here to talk about Heavenly Delusion by Masakazu Ishiguro, published by Dimpa Publishing, a publisher that I really enjoy, run by Ed Chavez, sort of the successor to Vertical Comics in a way, from Kodansha, in terms of like staff and making taste in the kinds of books they publish. And once I find like an editor or like a licensor who kind of reflects my taste, you know, I follow them around. Like, what else do they got for me? Where are they gonna what are they gonna pull off? And Dinpa is one where I pretty much have an inkling that I'll just try anything they do just because there's got to be something there. Kind of like how Deb says, like, she never understands my picks, but there's always like some kind of kernel of something in there. I feel very similarly about Dinpa. Even if I don't vibe with the books, there's like a twist. And with Heavenly Delusion, the twist is kind of that I know this author for their humor work. There's this series called And Yet the Town Moves. It's kind of about a maid cafe, and it's very wacky and postmodern and kind of not about anything, but it was so funny and so well written that it went on for, you know, 100-something chapters, several volumes at any rate. And so this one was a surprise to me because it's basically straight-up sci-fi. It's funny, but it's not a comedy manga in a way.
Yeah.
And it's how I found out that this, you know, really funny artist got his start doing science fiction, and the comedy was kind of a sideline. And his bio says, while he broke through the sci-fi genre, Ishiguro is best known for his comedies, particularly the Japan Media Arts Award-winning And Yet the Town Moves by Shonen Gahosha. Whimsical, stylish, and often surreal, Ishiguro's works are often put into their own unique SF genre, slightly fantastical. And I think slightly fantastical really fits with Heavenly Delusion. It's sort of, rather than reading the back cover copy, if I had to pitch it to someone just standing there, it's sort of like all the kids from Akira, the like espers in a post-apocalypse where there's also like different versions of them outside of their little like study session.
Yeah.
But it all comes together in this kind of really strange, weird, compelling mix for me. And it's so strange that I knew I had to bring it to Manga Splaining because, you know, we have such varied tastes and high expectations of our manga that I thought it could be a pretty cool conversation. So, Heavenly Delusion. I want to start with Christopher. You've been awake the longest.
I have.
How did you feel about this one? Did it strike your interest? Was it pretty cool?
It's super weird, actually. I need to say that I was given a review copy of this by Ed Chavez of Dempa Publishing 2 years ago. I think in the first month that the podcast started, he's like, hey, consider this. And I did not read it, actually, at the time. He also sent Invitation from a Crab, which we read and really enjoyed here on the podcast at the same time. That was more my speed. I started to read it, and I kind of bounced off of it. But honestly, last week, I was going through and read Skygrazer. Skygrazer is what it's called? Yeah, Skygrazer, a single-volume short story collection by Masakazu Ishiguro that Kodansha put out. And I'd heard about it online, and the cover is really nice, and it's another sci-fi book as well. Cover's like really beautiful. It's got this like really limited palette, beautiful graphic design. Totally interested in it. And it really messed me up. I'm going to be honest with you. I was reading it and it was like, it starts off and it's just like a full on gag manga for the first chapter. And then you realize that every character in that first chapter has this horrible, like wretched backstory that's like complicated about like real life, and there's just a lot like, what's real, what is a real person, like what are any of us? It's really weird, to be honest, and really good. It reminded me of when I hate to say it, but when I was going through Scanlations, when it was like before the manga boom, where I would be digging through and finding these like weird, beautifully drawn science fiction short stories that someone would be, you know, kind enough to translate in their spare time and throw up online. And that guy, this guy has like such a vibe there. Like, he's a post Akira, post Otomo artist for sure.
Yeah.
And Skygrazer, is great and also super problematic and also like absolutely worth reading. It's digital only from Kodansha. And so opening up this, I was prepared. I was like ready, and it did not fail. It did not disappoint. It met all of my expectations from reading Skygrazer. It is really beautifully drawn. It is really interesting, has complicated SF ideas that I think it's executing on at a pretty high level. It is super problematic in a couple of different ways that I am sure we will get into. And unlike Skygrazer, which ends pretty definitively and in a really satisfying way, this left me wanting more. I want to see the second volume. I'm not sure that I'm ready for it based on what's in the first one, but yeah, I'd keep reading for sure.
Okay. I will say that last night I was rereading this to, you know, prepare for the pod, and I ended up going straight through to volumes 2 and 3 and almost bought volume 4, but I didn't want to like skew the podcast, talk about a bunch of spoilers that hadn't happened yet, you know?
Yeah, I almost bought volume 2 too, but I was listening back to the last couple episodes and it was like, oh, I just kept reading on all these and I've ruined like so much of it. It's like, well, actually Midori-kun volume 4, this happened, and it's, yeah, okay. Yeah. So I decided I would just do the assignment this week, no extra credit.
Nice. And we'll keep it traditional manga-splaining and go to Deb next. How did you feel about Heavenly Delusion? Did this one infuriate you, like Die Dark?
No, it's pretty straightforward. Yeah. By comparison. I mean, straightforward in the sense, straightforward is maybe not the best way to describe it, because you go from chapter 1 mm-hmm. and then things change dramatically in chapter 2 and you don't know how you got from chapter 1 to chapter 2, but that's okay. Again, like kind of similar to Chris, this was one of those books that Ed said, this is one to watch and you should read it. Mm-hmm. And I took my time getting around to reading it because, one, I think it was this period of time when it was really hard to get the physical copies.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to Ed at this past Anime Expo, and he said that he licensed this one right away, like a few chapters in. And so he was so ahead of the curve that by the time it started coming out, the anime was running at the same time. And that rarely happens.
Yeah, this is a manga miracle.
And he's very proud of this one, and understandably so, because it's such an interesting bit of storytelling. The way that it reveals different layers of what's going on. Like you read chapter 1 and you get the sense of, you know, the kids are in the space and they're being told not to go outside.
Mm-hmm.
And there's little bits of dread being dripped out. And then all of a sudden, chapter 2, they are out there in the world and you see this world of decay and despair, right? And you don't know to why, and what did that ominous warning that the older woman said, you know, there are horrible beasts out there. You don't know what's going to happen. So like the way that, you know, the chapter 1 sets you up, chapter 2 puts you right in there, and then you're trying to figure out what happened between chapter 1 and chapter 2, and then, again, it drips it out.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really clever in that it keeps, like you were saying, like how both you and Chris found this so propulsive that you were immediately compelled to buy the next volumes. And that's good storytelling. You know, that's not a given. Not every story does that. Sometimes some stories you just stop in like chapter 2 and you're like, well, that's enough for me. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, I haven't read ahead yet, but I'd like to continue.
Nice. All right, Chip, what's your take? And also, did any of it seem familiar to you now that you've read 105 manga? I don't know.
I mean, like the Akira stuff for sure, obviously.
Yeah.
There's even some faces and expressions and stuff. I'm like, oh yeah, that's such an Otomo thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm much like Chris and Deb. Like I really enjoyed the kind of the revealing of things throughout this.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I didn't remember the pitch. I don't remember what you said when you pitched it to us. So thankfully my bad memory really came in handy here. Cause at first I'm reading, I'm just like, oh, okay. This is a story about like, you know, them being trapped in here. And this woman's clearly lying that outside's terrible and there's beasts because you don't trust the adults in these stories. Right. Especially the ones in charge. And then like cut to outside, it's terrible and there's beasts. Like I quite enjoyed that. And then like seeing, you know, the character that looks like the one inside. Like, there's some really nice little mystery bits that they've just kept dropping throughout this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily a big fan of Walking Dead style stories, like but this was like Walking Dead, but like a bit more focused. It felt like the Walking Dead stuff that I did like, which was like early on, mm-hmm. where you're just kind of like, you're wandering and you're kind of meeting people and you're kind of figuring things out and you kind of got your little routines. Yeah, I found all that like charming and interesting and some really nice kind of world reveals, especially when they get to like Tomato Heaven. yeah. So this sounds like, you know, the worst pitch of all time, but the whole book felt like Walking Dead meets Lost.
Yeah, actually,
because there's the post-apocalyptic kind of like searching for something, but there's also the mystery, like, oh, what is this gun? What is this symbol? Like, you know, why am I having these like these visions of things? And like, it really makes you want to go to volume two.
Yeah,
and it's really well drawn too. Like some really nice environmental stuff, which we don't necessarily get a lot of in the manga that we're reading. Like, it felt like there's a lot of effort put into this. Like, obviously, the Otomo influence, not quite on the technical level of Otomo, but who is? But yeah, some really nice poses, really nice kind of layouts. Yeah, I quite liked it.
I like the point about the environmental drawings, because before the podcast, I showed, you know, the team, the Mon Gang, a little sketch I've been working on this morning, just, you know, killing time.
Yeah.
And it's using Ishiguro's art as reference, like the way he draws trees and rocks, trying to get that effect.
Okay, yeah.
Like trying to find his problem solving. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty fun. Christopher.
No, I'm sorry, David, we didn't get your take.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I found this, I love stories where I don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's like, I can't believe this is happening or what the heck is going to happen next. Like, Gantz is kind of I can't believe this is happening. This is the dumbest thing in the world. I have to see what's going to be on the next page.
Yeah.
But this is more like, I can't believe this twist. Like, I never would have seen anything in this book coming, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Even down to the different motivations and kind of like what propels people forward. It's got a great mix of humor. Like, the jokes are really funny when they pop up. But the writing, I thought, was so, so well paced. Like Chip was saying, they're kind of like parsing out information, but they do it in a way to where just when you get used to what the environment is, what the setting is, it's like, oh, by the way, this kid can, you know, he's got magic powers too. You know, he's got the Maru touch or something. But it never feels like a rug pull or, you know, everything you know is wrong. It's just like, this didn't matter until now.
Yeah. And there is some good creeping suspicion too. So it's not a rug pull necessarily, because the hints are definitely there.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting too, like the reveals, like, you know, his power or whatever. In, let's say, a Marvel comic, that would be a splash page reveal, like,
yeah,
and let me do this, and you're like, whoa! But here, it's just part of the story, like it's not paced out that way. It's like you are just following them,
and it's very much an ongoing thing. It's not just like he can do this and that's it. That's how they're going to win. It's like he can do this, and like nobody really understands why. Yeah. Or how it works. And also weird things start happening with it. So like it keeps kind of snowballing into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I want to build on what you just said, Chip. I mean, about the way that things are, you know, just different than how a similar plot point would have been, you know, handled in an American comic book. Is there anything that you saw in here that you thought, damn, that's a banger idea. I think I'll do that next time.
Oh, geez. I don't know if there's any specific techniques besides that. I mean, I quite enjoy the idea of just like the gentle reveals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nothing that super jumps out. There are some good like page flip reveals in here for sure that I definitely didn't see coming. Like I really like that the whole story, you know, but like, you know, going to a town, encountering a new person, having another adventure, but like the innkeeper who, like, you know, drugs him to keep them asleep, and you're just like, you're trying to figure out why and stuff, and then when she reveals, like, oh, my son's inside, then they're like, no, it ate your son, like,
yeah,
like, no, it protects me and stuff, and then that next page where like her head is just lopped off in half,
that was,
I was like, oh man,
I didn't. Yeah, I was not prepared for that one.
Yeah, the fact that the smile is still on her face because it's happened so fast. Mm. It's a very good visual.
This reminded me a lot of Parasite.
Yeah, Parasite for sure. We should put Parasite on the list for next season. Mm. But I had the thought that the kids made the monster mad, and that's why it killed her.
Hmm.
There's so much wiggle room in there.
Yeah, yeah. You don't quite
what happened
know.
Happened. Yeah. Let's tackle some of the problematic stuff, Christopher. What did you have in mind?
There's some underage nudity in this volume that is definitely in the realm of wacky hijinks that a bunch of teenagers would probably get up to, but is also very lovingly rendered. Dude's a great artist. So it's I think you can get away with some of this stuff, but if you linger on it with the camera, it becomes creepy. And I think that that's the biggest problem with it. And I know it's going to come up in the comments. So I did a little bit of research on this because I'd heard, I can't watch this anime, whatever. And there is a scene later on in the series, rape scene, that is very divisive in the audience. And it's played absolutely awfully. It's not portrayed even it's not portrayed like this is, like the stuff in volume one is, but it is still so shocking and so horrible for people that read it and weren't expecting it that they've sworn off of the manga and the anime because of it.
Wow.
But also there's, there's the last page reveal in this. And I think we can get away without spoiling it. That has also triggered a lot of very shitty people. And so there's a lot of discourse about this book that is very bad faith as well. So it's really hard to, there's a lot of stuff in here that is very complicated to talk about on a podcast that you don't want to be demonetized. But I will say, I was this is digging through scanlations in the 2000s, the 90s and the 2000s, actually, because you'll flip a page and be the laws in Japan were very different 20 years ago. Things could be different on the page. All right, go to the next page. So and that's I don't know. It's an illustration. It's not a real anybody, but at the same time, it's man, it's maybe why this book is coming out from I don't know. Ed licensed it early because it's good and it's compelling, and it was bound to get an anime, and then it did, and the anime is apparently really good. But at the same time, I think this kind of material from a different publisher wouldn't necessarily fly. There'd be a lot more steam
Interesting.
Steam from the shower scene coming up to cover up some bits, that kind of thing. Because that's just that's what Viz does. It's what happened with Udon on Summertime Rendering that pissed a lot of people off. So I think that, I think you're getting the uncensored material here for better and for worse.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I thought of A Girl on the Shore while reading this quite a bit, actually. That's my peak, oh no, I can't read this on the bus. What am I doing?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But I thought this was less titillating in that vibe.
Oh, I found...
It's still very...
But Girl on the Shore was so grotesque, though. These are people... These are children that feel it's the end of their life. And they're just nothing they do matters. Whereas this is I got a creeper shot of the girl that we all like in our class and I'm sending it to you. And it's that's very realistic. But also, it's not... The story isn't what makes it a creeper shot.
Yeah.
It's how he drew it in the book. That's it's the approach to the material, not necessarily what's happening within the context of the story. Within the context of the story, Girl on the Shore is deeply disturbing, but it's meant to be. And I think but it's still all going to be hugely triggering for a lot of people who are do not want to see any sex or nudity in their books, let alone from a teenage character. So it's tough.
There's a bracing moment, I would say, I think in volume 3 with a different crew that they end up with, where I was oh, this is meant for adults, not in a pornographic way, but a lot of horrible things are going to happen sort of a way.
Yeah,
it's such an interesting balance for him to strike with this book, because there are wacky hijinks, but then there's also horrible things happening to people. But I never felt that the book was unbalanced in that realm, it tilted too far in either direction. Does that how did the mix feel for you?
Actually, Chip made a really good comparison with Walking Dead, and I totally agree with him there. But there's a scene that comes maybe right before Rick and Carl meet Negan. And they're basically camped out overnight in the flatbed of a pickup truck. And these two hillbillies come and restrain Rick and are going to rape Carl. And it is the most gut-wrenching scene that's happened in the book up until that point. It is awful. Mm-hmm. And Rick manages to just get free just in time to brutally murder both of them. And it's just like sobbing and like horrible afterwards. Really powerful writing, you know, like really, really good stuff. Mm-hmm. That is, that almost tilted the line for me. And I was like, whoa, this is like, yeah, it's the end of the world. But like, it was told in a visceral way, but it didn't really show anything. But then like 10 issues later, the stuff with Negan just like casually murdering people, like the ultra violence of where the series went at that point, I stopped reading. And I'd been reading, I'd literally bought issue one off of the racks. I just couldn't deal with it anymore. It was too much. And, you know, a lot of that's me. I've talked a lot about the podcast about how things get to be too much for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, the series went in a direction that it was just not where I could read anymore. It tilted too far. Yeah. But honestly, the introduction to Negan was maybe the most popular point in the entire series. And like, that's when the series just skyrocketed. And then there was the TV shows and all the stuff that came after. And he was a favorite character. People cosplay as him. And it's just like, yeah, he's a complicated character, but he's also bad. He's a bad person. He's not a bad person, but in a worse world, he's worse than the world, actually.
Yeah.
And that was the tilt for me. And since you asked,
there's always that weird balance. Like maybe I've mentioned it before here on the podcast, but like in my teen years, I read a lot of William Burroughs because of course I did. And I remember there was a book of essays, and one of them was an essay about him being approached to write a horror film. Because it was during, like, I think The Exorcist was big or whatever. And he's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll write a horror film for you. And he wrote this thing, and he sent it into the producers. Like, what the hell is this? This is, we can't show this to anyone. Like, it was, like, all about, like, cutting babies open and filling them with drugs and then, like, smoking the babies. I don't know. It was, like, horrible, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, William Burroughs.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, oh, okay, no, you don't want actual terror and horror. You want the scintillating line between true horror and, like, you know, comfort. Oh. And that's the truth. That's the truth with, like, any kind of fiction, especially when you're dealing with, you know, these kind of elements. It's like there's a choice there, like, how far do I push it? And, like, what's the comfort line for people? Because Walking Dead, the same thing happened to me. Like, I forget the issue number. It was in the 30s or whatever. And it was like an issue where it was like just torturing a woman for like a whole issue or something.
Oh, same. Yeah. That was the one where I bailed too.
Yeah. That was
the end. Yeah. Like, and I'm like, I'm a guy who can take a lot in the material I read, but I was just like, oh man, no, I just can't. I can't anymore. And I just, that was the end of it for me.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, again, like other people carried on and like, so it's a me thing. It's not the material. Like, the material is material no matter what. Like, it's up to me to kind of decide, like, okay, am I still in or am I out? Like, like where's my personal line? Because the author has their personal line. Mm-hmm. Every reader has their own personal line. Like, and if they don't, you know, line up, then you make then you make the choice to, like, to abandon it or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Deb, how about you? Where did you, like, were you particularly shocked?
Well, it's interesting because, like, as we're talking about this, you know, I was reading, a couple things came up for me, right? Like, one was The Promised Neverland, which
was a
story about a bunch of kids in this idyllic school, and then they find out that it's all a lie, that basically they are like veal in a pen, and they're being raised to be eaten by demons.
Super fun series.
And so then they escape, you know, into the world outside to escape this fate. And so there's some of that here. But that, you know, we were just talking about gore, right? Like, in horror. I was reading a series on Comic Key called Brutal. And it's about a police detective who seems really cool and calm and really put together. But he's a serial killer. And he focuses on killing the unredeemable. And he does it in a way that is extremely grisly.
Dexter.
Yeah, but
yeah, it seems Dexter.
It's really gross though, because like when they show the guy who did the original was his target, they show him like cutting the limbs off young girls, putting their bodies in boxes, and that there's flies, you know, landing on like flesh, right?
Yeah,
it's really disgusting. versus like when you see that scene where the mother gets sliced, right? It's basically like watching someone at Tsukiji Market cutting a piece of tuna.
It really is. It's weird.
It's just flesh. There's no blood spurting out. It's just chunks of flesh being artfully sliced by a very sharp knife. Mm. And it gives a different vibe. I mean, whereas like the one in Brutal where you're like, like that is just disgusting, but it feels real, you know? Mm. Like, yeah, that's what happens with flesh, right? It'll rot, it'll smell, and flies will come, and it's gross. But when in this book, even when they show that couple that's desiccated, it feels real, but it doesn't feel gross.
Yeah.
That makes any sense.
Yeah. There's like a spectacle of violence aspect where if it's too close to reality, then it like reminds you what it actually is versus like what it's pantomiming, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe because, you know, like with, you know, that thing with, you know, the body being sliced, it's kind of like, you know, like when we read a Blood Blockade Battlefront, where the building gets sliced, right?
Same
joke.
It's there for visual impact.
Yeah.
Not, I don't know, titillate you with the spectacle of death, I guess.
Yeah.
It's more metaphorical. It's more, you know, like I was watching that Formula One show again yesterday, and there was a scene where one of the drivers there's a huge, terrible accident. And one of the drivers actually does die. Noticed that they very tactfully did not show any close-up scenes of that crash.
Yeah,
they only showed off in the distance, and they, you know, boom, and people going, but you don't see this slow motion car tumbling over, crumpled or whatever. It's very respectful. And I thought that was interesting because this is odd, you know, because as it's revealed, right? Because I know when I watch that show, like, I see all kinds of horrifying crashes, but they're usually in glorious color and close-up, and then the bits of machinery are flying all over the place. And then the desperate calls in the race, like, are you okay? Are you okay? And he goes, I'm fine. And then they lift themselves out of the car, like, whoa, how'd that happen?
Yeah.
And then to see that how they handled an actual really bad accident, someone died, that was an interesting... That was, I think, a tasteful choice, but a very deliberate choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think taste matters a lot when it comes to stuff like this. And like Chip was saying, it's different for everyone. So, like, if it seems like the kind of book you might not like, you probably won't like it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
If you're hearing us talk about it and you're like, I'm not sure about this one, you're sure about it. Don't
like it's not like an endless slog of death and horror and unacceptable nudity, but like it is the kind of book where like The Outsiders or Lord of the Flies or something, where it's like very frank about what's going on with kids.
Yeah.
Volume 3, I think, is the one where it's like we have all these kids pinned up in our science, you know, institute. None of them know about puberty or kissing or even, you know, like relationships. But like puberty's happening, so they're starting to pair up. So like child sexuality and like their gender roles and things become like a text instead of subtext.
Yeah.
Which I think is another one of those things that Christopher mentioned. We didn't want to spoil for this episode, but it goes to interesting places without being too gross about it, but it doesn't necessarily pull punches at the same time, I would say, from what I've read so far.
Yeah. Yeah, the titillation thing is kind of, you know, a lot of our examples were like of horror.
Yeah.
The chances of that, like, you know, convincing someone like, maybe I do want to lop off someone's head, you know, in one clean go of it. Like, that's obviously very low, which is why, you know, that's kind of horror tends to be more permissive in society, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, you know, the underage nudity in here, like, you know, Chris pointed out, it's very lovingly rendered, and it could be rendered in such a way that it's like trying to arouse the reader. And that's where the kind of the real problem lies, because, like, you know, are you endorsing and like fostering an environment where, you know, people see this as okay and then enact it in the real life? Like, you read enough of this and you have that in your head and like, oh, it's fine. Like, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. Like, for me, it's not titillating at all.
Yeah.
but obviously not of the mindset of, say, someone who's into very young girls.
Yeah.
So that's a tricky.
It seems like the Bugs Bunny argument for me, though. Like, you don't watch Bugs Bunny and then go, you know, smack someone around with a mallet kind of a thing. And I think that you can approach it that way. But I think that, you know, people put things that they like into their work as well. So it's a difficult line to tread, for mm-hmm. sure. David, I remembered what this book reminded me of. Have you read Mojiro Kito's work? It's Shadow Star, which is from Dark Horse back in the day.
Nope.
And then Bokurano.
I read Bokurano and it hurt my feelings so bad I didn't make it past like the first volume.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah.
It only gets more. It's like Evangelion on hard mode. It's like we've taken these children and we've put them into a terrible situation that's far worse than anything that happens in Evangelion. And there's giant robots, and you're just like, oh,
yeah,
okay. And it's awful. Like, and every volume gets harder and harder and harder to read.
Actually, kind of like what we're talking about here, the small spoiler for Bokurano Hours, like the robots kill the kids as they use them. It's part of the concept. And I was like, this is too sad for me. Like, this is mixing something I love a great deal with something that makes me very sad in real life.
Yeah.
You know, like terminal illness, chronic illness, that kind of thing.
But also like child soldiers.
Yeah.
Like there's some real,
it was like tremendously awful effective comics making, I would say. Like it was good, but like I couldn't take it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's a good touch point.
But I do like that there's books like that out there that are challenging, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, that go where maybe go outside the boundaries of where most storytellers go. Well, we're not going to go there just to see what will happen. Like, I think a lot of times how I'll explain people the appeal of manga compared to like when manga first came on the scene to what was out there at the time was you know, like Ranma One Half was kind of naughty and funny and wild. And you would never, that would never happen in a Richie Rich. You know what I'm saying?
Not yet.
Well, given that the Archie like zombie flicks and hang out with the Ramones, who knows what's going to happen, right? And Big Ethel is now like a 20-something going back to her hometown getting a glow up. I don't know what's going to happen. So, but I'm just saying that
spoilers.
The fun thing is about manga is it goes sometimes to dangerous places, unexpected places, and it sometimes makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I think that this is probably similarly uncomfortable sexually as Evangelion, actually.
Yeah, especially End of Evangelion,
yeah,
you know, where they sort of all the subtext starts becoming text.
We're making this book sound like such a like art house Lars von Trier film.
But it's got gags, actually.
Yeah.
Can we lighten up the conversation?
Yeah, yeah.
David, you're always one for good gags. What was your favorite gag in this volume?
I, of course, you would say that. I have to say the incest joke.
That was actually really funny.
Which sounds terrible after this conversation. Essentially, there are two characters who are traveling together. They seem like brother and sister. And when they meet an innkeeper, the innkeeper's like, look, like I know that you all are on the run and it's a post-apocalypse, but like there's morals and ethics and like incest is not cool. And they all kind of sit there awkwardly for a moment. And they're like, one, we're not related. Two, we don't have that relationship. And just everyone's faces get red.
Yeah, it's so good.
That's the most like, and yet the town moves style joke in the book, I think, where someone is just so confidently incorrect, I think. And everyone else is just verklempt.
I like that Chris was like, all right, enough of this. Let's lighten it up. David, what's your favorite joke? The incest one.
I knew it was going to happen.
I liked the next beat of that joke too, where like they get back to the room and she's like, can you believe that she thought that? And he's like super grumpy and turns and moves his futon away from hers and is staring at the wall because he is completely in love with her too. And he's like, what's his problem? Totally oblivious to the fact. It was so good.
Yeah.
Ah, it was so good.
I'll say the clean one is the kid falling out of the tree.
Ah, that was good.
Cause that was like, holy crap. Like
when he's climbing on the like robots,
the kid climbs way up and something happens and they fall and then they bounce in a way that you only see like broken bones drawn. But like because the kid is sturdy, you know, they just pop up. They're like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
No. It's a good like dramatic irony thing for the reader, I think.
There are fun little touches throughout this book. And I really like that scene just because of the ingenuity of just like the kids thinking, oh, these robots can go on any surface. Maybe we can like use them to climb like.
Yeah,
really smart and funny.
My favorite visual gag was when he finds out, or one of the boys in the facility finds out that, like, the older guy he's got kind of a crush on, that's like the good artist, gave a drawing away. And then he like makes up with that girl, but then he walks over and he just like grabs the girl that's sitting next to him and like judo throws her out of the way.
I screenshot to that sit one down too. Next to
him. Yeah, yeah. I screenshotted yeah. that one. I was like, that was so great. Funny. It was like very, very cutely drawn.
Yeah. Chip, how about you? Was there anything?
I mean, I considered the head slicing a gag.
It kind of, yeah, I was fair. Thinking that too, actually.
So I think that's the one.
It's got a setup and a punchline.
It's a dark book.
Also, there's just something really funny about the visual and the feeling of like her pruning the toilet so she could sit on a toilet that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, oh, that's fun. That's another like fun little touch. The idea that there's like plants growing out of this toilet, but it's still a toilet.
Yeah. And Deb, how about you? What was yours?
I mean, I'm looking at sometimes there's these really funky little things like, you know, comments about styrofoam lasting forever.
Oh yeah, I love that. Yeah, human ingenuity. Like, they built things to last. I'm like, oh god, sure did.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was a great one.
Subtle, but you know.
Yeah.
This is kind of like a, you know, a David Brothers sweat the small stuff in moment kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you look through it, it's like, oh, there are these little things in there. It's like, that's a clever little aside, just kind of thrown in there, little throwaway line, little thing, and it's smart. It doesn't necessarily turn it into a comedy, but it does stop it from being like, you know, awful, grim, endless despair.
Yeah.
That it would otherwise be.
Hmm. There was a line when they have the pop quiz. I could have sworn that I screenshot it. Oh, where a character says, I'm sure of one thing, though. Just because you know a test is coming doesn't mean you'll know all the answers.
Yeah.
And the kid is like, should you look cool saying something like that?
Yeah.
That was good.
If you like those kinds of jokes and you've made it this far in the podcast, check out And Yet the Town Moves. It's a great anime, great manga, and it's full of that kind of like slapstick, I guess, humor.
Okay.
But I've got one last topic before we close out, and it's a manga-splaining tradition. Talking about the art. So we've mentioned Otomo. And there's definitely like a very clear Otomo influence, especially in everyone who lives like outside in the apocalyptic areas.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, some fun characters.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe it's recency bias, but I recently picked up a Hisashi Egoshi art book. You know, he's a classically cute cartoonist. And I feel like it's almost like cute Egoshi style faces with Otomo style backgrounds and rendering in a lot of this. That's a very like appealing vibe in a lot of different ways, but the Otomo way I think is maybe the most obvious. Christopher, how did it strike you? Anything come to mind?
Yeah, just Otomo. He's from that school of artists that's like Otomo. It sort of affected everything I did. He blew my mind, and now I'm not upset about it. Looks great. It did remind me a lot of Bokurano and Shadow Star. When I was reading it, Shadow Star has some great environmental drawings because it's set on a small island, one of the you know, small little uninhabited Japanese islands that had like a beautiful, it was like really well realized. And it also reminded me a little bit, even with some of the art, and it's kind of a tenuous connection, so I apologize, but Carlos B. McNeil's Finder.
Okay, yeah.
Back in the day. So there's a sequence, and it's always stayed with me, haunts me actually, where someone's giving a tour through this like city, this part of the city that's collapsed. And it's like, this is where you could see a piece of the shield that keeps the like solar radiation off of us collapsed and fell. And we still don't, like, we don't even know how it works or how to repair it. We're just hoping it holds up. And there's an ongoing sort of sub story in Finder that like all these things that we're building and the technology that we'll continue to build as humanity, we won't necessarily always remember how to like have made it. There's already things that, you know, are made that we can't make in the way that they were made. And that has a lot of, when they're like exploring, especially the styrofoam section they mentioned, that was great. But yeah, that was my touchstone for some of the art as well. Cause Carla doesn't draw anything like this, like is very, draws almost everything with a brush, like really like lithe and the movement's really interesting, but the environments always felt really real in Finder, like felt very much like these were real worlds and real places that were fantastic. And that was kind of the vibe here too. Yeah. Like, especially contrasting, like we could just say at the beginning, the sequence where Tokyo's double is sleeping inside a karaoke room. And for those of you that have been to Japan enough times, perhaps you've also slept in a karaoke room once or twice. And I was like, oh, that's so real. Those couches are so comfortable, sort of. And yeah, that felt really real. But then you go into these sort of like ruined bits of humanity. You go into the facility and you see, and it's all the environment. And so, yeah, that was the art that really stuck out at me, is like, yeah, the characters are cute and well-drawn, but man, does this artist take a lot of time to make this place, all of these places, feel real, even though they're not. And I thought that was awesome.
Nice.
Yeah.
And Chip, how about you? Anything stand out to you?
Yeah. I mean, there were a few scenes that, yeah, I quite enjoyed the environments, but this page in particular, which is just like, just a really nice kind of establishing shot of...
Which page is that?
I don't know which one, but yeah, because I took a screen grab.
We're on the crosswalk, the bus.
Yeah, sitting at the on the crosswalk, and like that kind of like,
yes,
a lovely. I'm a sucker for a lovely distance shot. I'm always putting them in my scripts, and my artists are generally ignoring it. But but it gives you such a sense of them being alone. It gives you a sense of like the order that used to exist with the crosswalk markings and the bus markings.
Yeah.
And with nature creeping in, and just like this two kids just looking at a map, like it's just really lovely.
I was going to remark on the pages immediately preceding it, when the bird creature debuts, like the way that it goes from this white silhouette coming from the right, lands on the thing, and then the next page reveal, you see what the creature really is.
Yeah,
so beautifully drawn, like, and the way the tendrils are so like so beautifully like windy, it's kind of designed.
Yeah.
It sets up both a mood of beauty and dread.
And yeah, absolutely.
Yes, exquisite. Then you immediately switch over to that scene you just described. And when I was reading through the next four or five pages, what amazes me is the camera angles he uses. You know, like he does like this above shot when they're walking, and then he goes to a close shot with them, you know, looking at each, you know, one person talking, and that's the next, like what they're seeing. And then after that, like on page, they're looking, and there's a perspective when they're seeing off in the distance these men.
Mm-hmm.
The fence is pointing straight at them. Like the kind of the way that he's not doing this talking heads thing that I see a lot of people do, right?
Yeah.
He's using very deliberate composition and angles to draw the eye in certain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Make reveals work. You know, even though the characters are cute, you know, they're stylized, it feels like a movie.
I can see that.
Yeah.
In terms of camera angles, yeah. You could definitely see them like traipsing through the post-apocalypse.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm flipping through looking for some good art of the initial kind of like bad guys that they encounter on the road.
Mm-hmm. They're so awful looking.
They're so awful looking, but I'm, but like they really are, like they're Otomo meets Dan Clowes.
Yeah.
But there's a bit I didn't like clock, obviously going kind of first time through, when the boy yells, "I'm a guy," and then the girl goes, "I'm a guy too," and he goes, "You lie." But like the fact that she says, "I'm a guy too," and then she says at the end. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You can tell like this isn't all just kind of made up on the spot.
Oh, there's some thought here. Yeah.
There's actual thought put into these plot points. So, you know, maybe my Lost analogy isn't the best, but
shots fired.
Wow, they admit it. But yeah, there's smart touches like that. It probably requires a good reread.
Yeah, the tomato heaven thing comes up loops back around rather, because there's tomatoes in the science experiment place.
Yeah, the first shot the first page. of the facility is tomatoes, which is like, oh, and you really had to have read the book for any of this, what we're saying, to make sense. I'm so sorry. It's available digitally wherever books are sold, but
yeah. I feel like every conversation.
But we just keep saying tomato heaven. Come on.
I know, but every conversation we have, like I can't imagine listening to any of our episodes without actually reading the book first.
Yeah, same.
But I would say like, you know, like tomatoes are an interesting choice, right? Because tomatoes to me are an example of something that tastes amazing if it's grown naturally. And something that tastes horrible when it's grown in a factory setting.
Mm. Mm.
right?
I'm like, sensing a metaphor.
Because it's like, you know, like I for years I hated tomatoes. Like the tomatoes that would get shipped to us in Hawaii tasted just mushy and, you know, flavorless. And there's just like, what do people like about this, right? When I first came to California and grew my own tomatoes, I'm like, you could pop them off the vine and pop them in your mouth. I go, well, oh, that's why.
Did I tell you guys that tomatoes here in Taiwan are treated like fruits?
Yes.
Yeah. Basically, multiple times here in Taiwan, I've gone to the grocery store to buy like, oh, there's like a little plastic fruit cup or something like that. And it's like, what is that? Is that some sort of weird cherry? Nope. That is a tomato. That is a cherry tomato in the fruit cup with like grapes and blueberries or whatever, strawberries. And also, I believe Deb mentioned, yes, they do on the street. They sell dango, like mochi, like Japanese dango, like little, like soft, squishy, like sort of rice. I don't know how to explain, like rice dough almost, but then it's dipped in something sweet. So they sell those with like a glaze on top that hardens like a candy glaze. And they also do it with fresh strawberries, which is really, you know, it's good. Andrew hates it because it's like you're biting into, it's like biting into a candy apple. It's like hard candy and it like sticks to your teeth or whatever. It's for kids, right? But yeah. They've also got it with cherry tomatoes. So there's like a skewer with like 4 or 5 cherry tomatoes on it covered in like hard candy that's been melted on top of it. And it is insane, and it's like wonderful. Like food means,
oh my God,
tradition means nothing here. We'll do it. My favorite is the ice cream that is made with it's 2 scoops of ice cream in like a flat, like almost like a tortilla, but like a thin crepe wrapper with a shaved peanut brittle that, so it turns into like a peanut dust with some sugar in it, and then cilantro is sprinkled on top. And then they wrap the whole thing up and you eat it like it's an ice cream sandwich. And it's cilantro, peanut brittle, and vanilla ice cream usually. Like, and it is, your brain at first is like, why am I biting into greens in ice cream? Like, it's like a salad vibe.
Yeah.
The cilantro hits and you're like, this is actually the best thing I've ever eaten. It is so good. I crave
tomatoes are a deal breaker, but that one sounds pretty good, I think.
Yeah. The night market food here is legit. But the tomatoes, I can't get over how they use tomatoes here. It's fantastic.
Wow.
We should probably do final thoughts.
Oh, right. Manga. We're talking about manga. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll have snacks waiting later. Let's go, Deb, Chip, then Christopher. Deb, what's your final thought on Heavenly Delusion?
One, I think it's really an amazing book. It's interesting to read. It doesn't reveal its secrets very easily. It really tantalizes you and keeps you wanting to learn more. It has flavors of the things we've all discussed, like The Walking Dead, The Lost, The Promised Neverland, Akira, and all these kind of things, but it is something wholly different and original on its own. I see the point where people are saying some things make them uncomfortable. Mm. And my argument is, as long as you go in with your eyes open and take it for what it is, I think it could be a really enjoyable read. But I think it's also, you know, good to know that ahead of time so that you're not, you know, running into something and going like, what the hell, and throwing it across the...
Yeah.
You know, throwing the book across the hall, right? Because you're just like, no, this crosses a line that I cannot tolerate. Mm. And that's different for everybody. For me, it makes me a little uncomfortable, but it doesn't make me angry. And it doesn't trigger me like in a fit of, how dare they? This should never be, you know, out there. But I will say that for all you librarians out there, please try carefully with this one. It is a fascinating book, but purchase for your collection. Caution.
Pretty good. Thank you. Chip, how about you?
I quite liked it. And if anyone was smart about it, this would be an HBO series before next year.
I agree.
Because really, Walking Dead meets Lost meets Akira. It's like, oh, come on. Just like put it, strap some kid actors to this and let them have a go.
Maze Runner, that shit. Just do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maze run it into the ground.
Yeah.
Christopher, how about you?
Maze Runner, that shit. Run it into the ground. That's that's my quote now. I dash, you know, copyright Christopher Butcher. No, it was good. Yeah, it was a fun. It's a really compelling mystery, and I want to see what happens next. I don't know. I hope when Ed hears this, he sends me the rest of the volumes.
That's right, people. We're shameless.
Yeah. Very shameless. But no, I forgot that he sent it to me, so I bought it today and then read it and really sort of luxuriated in it and did some research on it. And then I was like, wait, did Ed send me this? And sure enough, he did. Found it. So that was funny. So yeah, this is a good one. And I think it's, a great, it's a really solid, really smart, old school seinen SF manga that I would recommend. It's got great stuff going on, and it is, but it also has stuff in it that's like not going to be for everyone, and you just have to decide if that's you. And I think that's fair.
Pretty fair.
David?
So I read this when it came out after buying it with my own money, much like Christopher. And I liked it then. It was one of those ones where I finished it and I was like, that was pretty interesting, but I didn't like keep pushing. There's just the one volume out, and you know, like a bunch of manga comes out all the time, so I lost track. But picking it up again, I'd also forgotten my pitch, much like Chip. And as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is still pretty good. So I rolled into 2 and 3, and I'm very much enjoying it. I'll probably finish reading volume 4 later today. But I think that, like, Co Ransom translated it. Nicole Docic lettered this one. And I think they did a great job of the localization. Like, the dialogue was really smooth. The jokes landed, which is always really tough. But mostly, this is just, like, unpredictable. And that's still one of my favorite things about any kind of book or movie or anything. Like, I don't know what's going next, even having read up through volume 3. Like, I have an idea kind of maybe of where they want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But mostly it's just Ishiguro setting up all these dominoes and then knocking them down, like, where I can't see. Yeah, there's so many. There's this joke where the two are talking about, like, oh, if we see people who recognize you, this is probably where you're from. This is probably heaven. And the kid is like, oh, I never thought about that. Then the very next slide is someone going, hey, that face, you know, and it's not like the right face.
Yeah.
Just all this irony and, I don't know, swift writing, let's say. Heavenly Delusion, sure. I'm into it. For some reason, the volume 2 ebook isn't on Kindle. You have to go to the Denpa website for that. But I recommend this one. Like everyone's saying, it's tough in places, but it's really good in other places. And I think it's well worth the trip, let's say. I'm still not sure why it's titled Heavenly Delusion. I assume that's going to come into play later, but it's a good title too.
Yeah.
But all right, we're going to take a break. We're going to play a little bit of music. You're going to hear an ad or two, and then we're going to do some shout outs. You probably also just heard a motorcycle speeding by the freeway. We will catch you in a bit.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we are back. We just had a great offline conversation about John Bogdanow's X Factor and the effects it had on us as kids. And we are here to shout out some other stuff. I think that, Deb, you've got a relevant shout out for us, maybe?
Sure. I guess what I would say, like, if you like this book, if you liked Heavenly Delusion, a good second book to read, or maybe just a good book in general to read, is The Summer Hikaru Died. It's by Moku Mokuren. And it's basically, again, about young people. But this premise is that there are two boys living in like a rural town. They're besties. It's the summertime. It's hot outside. You can hear cicadas creep. You know, they're eating ice cream. They're hanging out. And then we find out that one of the boys, Hikaru, disappeared in the mountain for a couple of days, but came back. And then we find out that the other boy says, you're not really Hikaru, are you? We discover that Hikaru's body has been taken over by a mysterious creature from the mountain. And there's some really dazzling reveals where the creature, the Karu turns to his friend and his face is melting and turning into something, a monster. And he goes, how did you know? Mm. Oh, it's gripping. And it's the story reveals are really interesting. And the monster basically begs and is like, you can't tell anybody. This is the first time I'm really enjoying myself. I've always wanted to be a human. And so the way that the secret gets hidden from everyone around them in this small town. And what is actually in the mountain? We don't know. Really interesting horror storytelling, a lot of dread, but it's just gorgeously drawn and kind of surreal. It's only up to 2 volumes now. I think it's only up to 4 volumes in Japan. It's won a ton of awards. It's one that I've been telling people to pick up now because it's so good.
Wow. Nice.
Cool.
It actually reminds me of a little bit of Summertime Rendering, which is doing some work for Udon. So it's a bit of a conflict of interest. But no, for real, Summertime Rendering is about this guy going back to his hometown. And because his sort of childhood crush has passed away, but she drowned. And she's like, well, how could she drown? She's such a strong swimmer. They live on the island. And you sort of gradually realize that something that is part of this like quaint small town religious sort of situation is actually something very, very dark is happening and has been happening over and over again for thousands of years on this one island. And it's really good. Like the mystery is really good. It's not, there's a couple of creepy moments, but it's not played like a horror. It's definitely played more fantastic than that. But I was shocked when I was reading it because it's such a page turner. Like you really want to see what happens next. So I think if you read the first volume, you'll be hooked and want to grab the rest. But that wasn't my shout out actually, although sure, I get two.
One per this week.
Yeah, you're done.
No, I want to say Skygrazer, which I mentioned earlier, and I didn't sell it as well as I could have, but it's by the same author as today's book. But like the first chapter is about these like 3 sweaty teen nerds who are trying to figure out how to steal porno magazines from the local bookstore. And it's like so perfect and awful. And it's like the shelf of devils, the shelf of angels, the shelf of goddesses. And it's like so good. And these kids are like hilarious and like it's dumb and funny and whatever. And then you realize that each of these 3 kids, like I was saying, is not what they appear to be as the story keeps going. It's phenomenal SF writing, like really good. Lots of the humor, I think, David, that you were mentioning in his other series that permeates it, but also just like the darkest turns as you're reading it. You're like, what, really? So yeah, that's my sub shout out is that, yeah, this sweet, sweet story of Stand By Me for the new generation turns into just terrible, terrible stuff by the end of the volume. It's fantastic. In a Stephen King way, actually, even. So, so yeah.
You convinced me. I bought the volume while you were talking.
Oh, shit.
Wow.
Yeah. There you go.
I won 2 this week. That's great.
Though I had a follow-up question for you. Now I can't. What was your... Never mind. I lost it.
By Summertime Rendering? Yes, absolutely. You should.
I had a joke and it just went right out of my head. It was so good.
So sorry.
Chip, what do you have for us? Do you have a shout out?
Well, I have a follow up from last week's pre-shout out, which I was shouting out Doppelganger by Naomi Klein. And now I finished it so I can fully shout it out.
Nice.
It's amazing. And it's the kind of book where she so thoroughly dissects kind of everything happening in the world right now that almost every conversation I've been having the past week, if someone mentions any kind of topic, I'm like, well, that's interesting because Naomi Klein says, I sound like an asshole basically everywhere I go. But it's so good. She's so good at spotting patterns in the way the world works and what's kind of happening underneath the surface and between left and right and politics or whatever. And it all comes down to capitalism. Spoiler.
Weird.
Yeah, I know. But besides that, the other night I finally watched Martin Scorsese's King of Comedy, which I had never seen before. Have any of you seen it?
I've seen Long Joker, ago. But I've not seen King of Comedy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, then you've basically seen King of Comedy. It's pretty amazing. It's about, like, Robert De Niro plays a stand-up comic, which itself is hilarious, just that idea. Desperately trying to get on this talk show, which is hosted by Jerry Lewis. And Jerry Lewis is remarkable in it. As like the host of the show, like the Johnny Carson style guy. Mm-hmm. And De Niro just kind of loses his mind throughout, insisting that he's going to be the next thing, the next big thing. And he keeps getting the runaround. He keeps pushing and pushing and pushing to get on the show until he, like, essentially kidnaps Jerry Lewis. But there's a scene where Sandra Bernhardt's in it, and she plays like a wacky fan of the Jerry Lewis character. And it's her trying to seduce Jerry Lewis as he's taped to a chair. And I'm just like, I never pictured those two in a movie before. And it is amazing. It's so good.
I love Sandra Bernhardt so much. I had no idea she was in it. You've actually made it to me. Oh my God.
It's really funny because it plays like her and De Niro as like kind of buddies who were both obsessed with Jerry Lewis, but for different reasons. And like,
that's actually
like
such a good, oh, that's good.
It's so good. The interactions between them were just like, no, you're crazy. No, you're crazy. It's just like, well, you're both are. Like, it's really intense and really fun and funny. Yeah, so yeah, big recommendation for me. It's also probably not the movie I should have watched before going back to a comic convention. I realized halfway through as my anxiety started to rise, I'm like, oh God, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that actually reminds me. I saw The Creator last weekend, which was fine. Oh, yeah. Like, it was filmed in order, I guess, or something. that's mean. Wow. It's an okay movie.
Yeah.
But the two trailers that played before, you'll never believe this, were The Marvels, which looks pretty good.
Yeah.
And Killers of the Flower Moon, back to back.
What?
Which is the new Martin Scorsese movie, which could be further from, like, they're both very good entries in their lanes.
Yeah.
But their lanes are in different states, you know.
I like the idea of counter programming trailers.
Yeah. That made me laugh a lot.
Yeah. But
my shout out this week is a concept following in Christopher's tradition of telling people to go touch grass. I think that this is a good week to get used to being bad at something. Like, pick up an instrument or try to draw something, do something that you're not good at. Because it turns out there's like no consequences. Who knew? You can just keep doing it, getting better and better, and nobody can stop you.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea, but there are consequences for my sexual partner.
It's very true. Very, very true.
Yeah. Just, I'm not very good at it.
Practice makes permanent. That has been an episode of Mangasplaining. We covered Heavenly Delusion by Masakazu Ishiguro. We had a bunch of good shout outs. We revealed way too much, as usual, on our podcast. And we will be back next week to do the exact same over and over again. We will see you soon.
This has been Mangasplaining, episode number 111. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Akira Volume 5 by Katsuhiro Otomo, the last book of this season. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com and check out our newsletter and digital publishing endeavor at mangasplainingextra.com. Thanks to DADS for the musical accompaniment this episode.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.